Accession number 29238, Reel 4.
Mr. Wiggum, Reel 4. Did you have any duties to carry out whilst you were at Norwich?
Well, just training, really. By then, you see, we'd become the anti-tank regiment instead of field. And we had got some of the 2 pound anti-tank guns, which were lovely little jobs, but just pea shooters, really. And so squads of us went down in the wagons to the coast, to a place called Rayburn, where the 21st Anti-Tank Regiment, regular regiment, which had, or those who'd got out from Dunkirk, were stationed. And we trained on the guns there under their guidance. And it didn't take us long, of course, to get the hang of the new guns. And then we did manoeuvres around the district. I enjoyed the period at Norwich. And then in the winter...
Did you do any other kind of training there whilst you were there? I'm talking about basic training, like fitness training, PE, anything of that?
Oh, well, we did PE within the, you know, within the battery. That, another bombardier and I were sent down to the city, I forget who it was who trained us, as sort of PE instructors. I've never been able to touch my toes in my life. And they, by Jove, we needed a hot bath when we got back. They just about tied us in knots. And from then on, we got the onerous job of taking the PT parades, which are never particularly popular first thing in the morning.
But what did they consist right. of?
Well, you know, usual jerks and the usual jumping up and down and waving your arms about and sort of thing. And occasionally we'd organise a cross-country run, which was very popular, of course, with them. Nobody wanted that. But...
Did you do any route marches?
Oh, we did route marches, yes. We'd done route marches back at Sunderland. But we did that sort of thing. But we were concentrating mainly, of course, on the anti-tank tactics and the guns. And when the winter came, was approaching, we left Catton Park and went into my battery, into a big house called Eastwood House. And that was our winter quarters.
What was that like? Can you describe it?
Well, I'm a bit vague in the memory now, but it was a big old house. Obviously, people of some note, you know, who'd lived there. For instance, my troop, the lads were billeted in a big bedroom, and I was very lucky. I got a nice little cubbyhole to myself. Off that room there was the gentleman's dressing room, you know, and I had my father's First World War camp bed, and so I set up shop as bombardier in this little gentleman's dressing room all to myself. Of course, when I say all to myself, the door was never closed because I was sort of a bit responsible for what was going on in the main room. So that, you know, I was with them, but I had my own a little bit more space than they had, shall we say. And that was quite nice, was that? And we carried on with gun drill and one thing and another. And we got odd jobs to do out of the ordinary. For instance, one day, my battery reconnaissance officer, it's a Sunday, saw me and well, he said, I want you immediately after lunch. Well, here we're going to get your gun and crew and full kit. And we're going off. I don't know just where we're going yet or what we're going to do. But we're meeting Major Castle from regimental, divisional artillery headquarters. So we met Major Castle. And he took us away off down into the Norfolk marshes around Marsham. And we wandered away with the wagon through these blooming marshes. And what on earth I had the gun for and all our gear, I do not know, but that's the sort of thing that happened. Because what we had to do when we got there was build a target which was just three posts and sacking around them, and that was a target for practice for the field artillery. So why on earth we had to trail a gun with us, I have no idea. That, but the funny thing was that the ground was very soft, of course, as it was in the marshes, you know, and we, as always, we didn't really have the right gear. We had a pick. The pick was no good there. But Major Castle, nice bloke, very tall man, decided that we'd use the pick crossover as a hammer to drive these posts in. And so we had to stand and hold the posts while he, being very tall, tried to batter them in, which wasn't very successful. And the one advantage about being in full gear was we had our tin helmets on, because one time he missed and hit me on the head with the blooming pick. I think I went in probably as far as the post did. Anyway, we decided that wasn't much good, and he said, look, I wonder if we could push it in. So he and I and a couple of blokes, we got around this thing and just let all our weight go at once, and we shoved the post into this marsh, you know, quicker than trying to bash them in. But we got that done, and that was a bit of a diversion. And another time, I think it was the same officer, had me, I picked me, turn out with all my crew. And somebody else, I don't know, I think it was a Castle again. And we went away down to the coast. Nice fine day. And we ran along a lane, the coast, and we stopped beside a pillbox. And there was a brass hat there and some others. And we just got out, fell in. Didn't hook the gun. We hadn't been ordered to at that time. And the brass hat came up to me and said, I want you to have a look at this bombardier, Susan. He said, I'd like you to put your gun in there. He said, they've been built specially. That's 2-pounder gun positions. And he said, I'd like to see how, if you can, you'd get your gun into it. So I went and had a look. And I said, I don't know who designed this, so, but and get the gun in, but not if you wanted it in a hurry. I said, instead of the normal method of hand spike, I said, we'd have to use rope slings and the hand spike in the slings to get the blooming gun down, because they haven't left room to put the hand spike in. He said, that's what we're afraid of. Had a little compartment built in next door, old Vic, for the gun crew to live in, you know. And he said, look, I want you to tell me, Bombardier, just exactly what you think should be done with this blooming thing. So I told him, which then Taylor nearly been knocked down, you know. I said, that's the only way, if you want to get the gun in a hurry. And I said, you'd never get it out in a hurry, which could be, you know, it could be the loss of a gun. I said, it's just ridiculous. You know, whoever built this hadn't any idea how you put a 2-pounder gun down on his legs. Yes, well, he said, as a matter of interest, there's 250 of these being built up the coast. Oh, my God. So that was another little diversion, you know, which was interesting. But we got things like that to do. But the most severe one I got, I think, which finished up much brighter than it started. The winter was absolutely blisteringly cold, you know. And 9 o'clock at night or something like that, I made the mistake of staying in my nice little room in the book. And the orderly sergeant came along and, oh, Wig, we've got a job for you. I said, oh, Lord, what now? Well, you got to get a guard, the men who are in, 5 men, and yourself. I said, we're going out. Oh, he said, you are. He said, I'll be coming with you, and then coming back to guard a Blenheim bomber. Just have to make a forced landing. And we've got to guard it overnight. I said, why can't the bloody Air Force do that? Because there were loads of Air Force lads around Norwich. However, our CO was OC Troops of Norwich, so we got all these jobs, you know. And so I got 5 blokes and we set off. And went away out, finished up on the edge of a ploughed field, and across on the other side was this Blenheim bomber, flab on its belly, and hadn't been shot down, it had iced up. Nobody had been hurt as it happened, fortunately. Well, been shaken up, no doubt, but it was a bit concertina. There was ammunition lying around, one thing or another. That's why, of course, it had to be guarded. And I've never known such a night. When we walked across the ploughed field to have a look at it, the ploughshares didn't even crack under our boots. You know, you walk from one sharp edge to another, right away across. It was frozen solid. And our guard room was just a 1,500-weight truck with a canvas back. And so we were stuck there all night, and until we got a relief next morning. But when our breakfast came out in what they called the hay boxes to keep it warm, you know, a message came out with it. Oh, another bombardier came out with it, that was it. And the message that I had to report straight back to the headquarters at Eastwood House, because I was gone up that morning in orders, an appointment as Lance Sergeant. So that was a better end to it a bit, you know. That is the highest dizzy heights that I got, of course, was Lance Sergeant. And so then, of course, I had to move from my nice little room and go and join the sergeant in the sergeant's mess, which was in a terrace house on Constitution Hill. And we were there until we moved. It was a good, decently nice accommodation.
How did your role change when you were promoted?
Well, more responsibility, of course. I was still gun commander of the same gun, you know, but I had other duties to do, orderly sergeant duties and this sort of thing.
What was that, orderly sergeant's duties?
The orderly sergeant, he was the sergeant on duty for the day, on general duties around the battery. I mean, you got the battery out on morning parade and had them all paraded up ready for the troop commander or battery commander to come out and inspect them, etc. And you went round the meal tent with the orderly officer and you did rounds of the guards with the orderly officer at night and one thing and another. And you were generally sort of there all day at base for anything that that came up with certain duties like the guard inspections, etc. You know? I was Lance Sergeant. Now, Lance Sergeant, it's funny, Lance Sergeant is not a promotion, it's an appointment. What they call your war substantive rank was the full rank, full sergeant. So my war substantive rank was bombardier, which I'd been before. So that if I misbehaved myself or anything like that, I could be immediately reduced back to bombardier. To get me below bombardier, I have to be court-martialed because it was my war substantive rank. And we had more lance sergeants than full sergeants, actually, in the battery.
Your gun crews, how many men were there for each crew and what were their roles?
There were a crew of five, including yourself. The gun commander was gun number one, as they called it. Now he stood with his head above the gun shield, looking for targets and things, and giving his orders to swing the gun round towards the target and then give the gun there, the order, target right, target left, so many yards range, and the amount of lead, in front of the moving vehicle, because if you didn't keep in front of it, you missed it. And then the gun layer, of course, he was the man who did all that and fired the gun with a foot pedal. And then he had an ammunition number who had his cabinet of ammunition alongside him, and as soon as the gun fired and the shell ejected, he put another one in and rammed it up. And then there was the other number four. He was what you might call an ammunition number, really. If you were getting short and you had to perhaps run back to an ammunition store and get more ammunition and anything like that. And then number five was the driver. And he had a Ben gun on a stand for anti-aircraft work or anything like that, you know. But everybody had a job to do.
How was the rest of the battery organised? How many guns were there?
There were four guns in a battery. No, what am I talking about? There were four guns in a troop. There were three troops in a battery. That's 12. And there were four batteries. So a 48-gun regiment.
What about transport? How were the guns transported?
In our cave with the 2-pounders, what they called a portee. The portee were really designed for desert. They were high-ish wagon, canvas covered, no windscreen, open fronted, and there were no floor as such in the back. There were two ramps that fell down, sort of channeled. Those channels ran into the wagon, and you had a hand winch and cable and hook, and you hooked onto the gun and you towed the gun up into the back. That's why I got the name of portee, because it carried the gun, you know, and the spout or, you know, the muzzle, it was sticking way out over above the driver's cab, and then the lamps were fastened up, and there were places for the lad. I mean, there was a seat in the gun, which was the gun layer's seat. So he got there, and then a seat for the rest, but there was no floor as such. And that's how I think there were Bedfords, I'm not sure. I can't quite remember now what they were. But that was the transport. But good wagons. Don't think they ever let us down on manoeuvres or anything.
Did you do any other kind of basic training? Did you do rifle training, for example?
Oh, yes. Yes, well, every man had rifle training. Every man had a rifle. Except the gun number ones. And they had an out. for some reason or other. They had nothing at all. But I got permission from the battery commander to carry. I never carried it in this country, but for interaction, to carry my father's 45 revolver from the First World War. But I don't know whether later they ever gave. I think I have a feeling that I did get a rifle. I'm a bit hazy on that now, whether we ever eventually did, but for a long time, at any rate, the number one hadn't any personal weapon at all. But a bayonet, it's a sidearm, you know, that we carried that, but so perhaps we had a rifle by the time we left England. Of course, there was a shortage of everything, you know. We had old rifles from Canada and all over the place, apart from the Lee Enfield, which was the best of the lot. The rifle of the 303 Lee Enfield. But we, you know, we maneuvered around the place and we did various tasks. One of the biggest tasks was after we left Norwich. We left Norwich on, I think it was New Year's Day, 1942, in absolutely freezing weather, snow, and all the rest of it, in a 7.5-mile convoy, an old regiment. And we were heading up north, we didn't know where. And how were we doing for time? And I was in one of the, well, my gun tower in the front, you know, and we had the motorbikes, the dispatch riders, or Donars as they call them, and they went ahead and we got the crossroads, they stopped and made sure that everybody went the right way. Our dispatch rider, a small fella, a nice lad, he'd been my, before he went on the motorbike, he'd been my gun rider, a fucking good gun rider, also Deuce, or Squidge. And after we hadn't been going very, very far, when the bike went one way on the ice, and Squidge went the other, and whacked his head and really knocked him dizzy. So, I got him in the wagon, and my section sergeant, who was the full sergeant in my section, and I, Don Denton, and I decided that we'd spell each other taking over the motorbike. Because to drive it all day in those conditions, you wouldn't improve instead. And so we did that. We did a spell, and then we were feeling like we'd just got too far as we'd go. We'd weigh down, and the other one would take over, and do it that way. And the first night stop was Peterborough. And then we were going on to Catrick. And we got to Catrick, and I was on the motorbike at the end of Catrick, and I slid in there more or less sideways down the slope. And it snowed that night. It was snowed. And we got snowed into Catrick for 3 days, couldn't get out. And so we decided then that the motorbikes were going to go up under one of the wagons. And we'd do the allowing in the officers' little officer utility vans, you know. And this was much more comfortable. But it was 3 days before we could get out of Catholic. We were then supposed to. The next stop was supposed to be Fenham Barracks at Newcastle. And then on we learned from there up to Duns in Scotland. However, we'd lost 3 days. So it was decided that right, we were going to bash through the Duns in one day. And it was a long day, believe me. And, you know, we battled on. The A1 in parts was just single line traffic with banks of snow either side, and this 7.5 mile convoy, and we trundled on the way we got to Duns, which is also heavily in the snow, and we were in missing huts, and we were there for a week or two. And then they started to move us around the batteries to different places.
What were you doing there?
Well, what we were doing, as it turned out, what we were doing, we were moving up towards the fly for embarkation. And we didn't actually. We had a good idea that something was on the move, but we didn't know exactly what was happening. And then they started from Duns, they moved us all west. My battery, A battery, went to Thornhill, about 12 miles from Dumfries, and another battery went to Galashiels. I'm not sure where the other two batteries went, but it was quite amazing. We set off from Duns, wrapped up the ears in the front of the, I mean, these were open front of trucks, as I told you, you know, in that weather. And all this weather, and we headed off towards the west, towards Dumfries. We were going to go by St. Mary's Lock. And we went over the moors and climbed up onto the moors, and we went round a corner And I just gasped, I couldn't help it, because there was a snow line in front of us, across the road, and beyond that the road was clear. And we just ran out of winter, as you might say. By the time we got down to St. Mary's Lock, we were stopping there for our haversack rations, we were taking our great coats off and everything else, it was so warm, and we carried on from there into Thornhill, just in our battle vessels.